And, of course, yesterday Apple launched a new and improved version of the iPad. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, Apple is not holding back on the superlatives.
Apple CEO Tim Cook calls it the post-PC revolution.
We're talking about a world where your new devices, the devices you use the most, need to be more portable, more personal, and dramatically easier to use than any PC has ever been.
That's Cook speaking yesterday at an Apple event in San Francisco, where he was pushing a world where people carry iPads and iPhones instead of owning desktops and laptops. Cook claims that last year Apple sold more iPads than any PC maker sold of its computers. Then Cook and other Apple executives lifted the veil on the newest iPad. Its most lauded upgrade is its resolution, which Apple Marketing Vice President Phil Schiller says is better than your HD TV.
Everything you do, it's just going to look stunning, surfing the web, reading your emails.
Though the changes seemed like a simple upgrade, Forrester research analyst Sarah Rotman Epp says it will make it easier to use your iPad for work, and there are new apps to help you.
And this is professional-grade software letting you accomplish real tasks on a post-PC device.
The new iPad also takes dictation, making it possible to write without a keyboard, and it has 4G wireless. Apple lowered the price of the older version of its tablet, the iPad 2, to $399, a move probably meant to help it compete with the much lower-powered Amazon Kindle Fire, which sells for $199. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This week, San Francisco is hosting the Game Developers Conference. It's the largest global event for the industry that makes video and online games. 20,000 people from 100 countries are there right now. And a game that hasn't even been created yet is getting a lot of attention. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Arthi Shahani reports.
A few hundred conference goers crowd into a room at the Moscone Convention Center. On stage, developers from Double Fine, well-known independent game makers, talk about raising money to develop new games.
If we're going to pitch it, we actually have to pitch it, you know, to the suits, right, to publishers. We're going to have to make this game.
Nathan Martz is referring to the well-known tension between the creative developers and the business suit publishers. Sitting to his right is company founder Tim Schafer. Schafer blows kisses into the air, as though his colleague's point needs illustration. The audience gets the joke. Awkward laughter. Schafer wants to free developer and fan alike from the grip of controlling publishers.
What if there are a lot of adventure game fans out there who want an adventure game? I wonder if there's some way that I could talk to them directly and cut out publishers altogether.
Schafer poses this rhetorical question in a YouTube video released a few weeks back. He was launching his campaign to raise money for a game that, he says, no major publisher was willing to pay for. After just a few hours online, Schafer hit his goal of $400,000. Days later, he got to $2.4 million, by far the biggest success story in the history of Kickstarter.com, the website he's been raising money on. His 70,000-plus backers won't turn a profit, but they'll get rewards, like a free game or even a credit in it, depending on how much they pledge. Blocks from the convention, back at Double Fine Studios, Schafer employs about 60 people. Fussing with a Rubik's Cube, he talks about the limits of games, as an industry. Publishers want the usual bloody, kill-em-all shooter games, the proven mega-hits.
The big companies are not going to create games that are going to be good for the overall art form. They're not going to progress, you know, how expressive the games are and how emotionally relevant they are and how fulfilling they are from an artistic point of view.
The game industry is huge. It's expected to make $33 billion this year. That's about equal to the movie box office worldwide. Schafer has the star power of an Oscar-winning producer.
When I first saw what he was doing, I kind of laughed and thought it was like, you know, Martin Scorsese doing a crowdsourcing project to try and fund his next picture.
That's Jeff Brown, communications VP at Electronic Arts. They're the top game publisher in the U.S. Brown questions whether regular indie developers can replicate a celebrity's home run. But he does note that crowdfunding may well have a future because, as new players flock to the Apple Store and Facebook,
the games that they're playing are a lot cheaper, they're a lot simpler, and the barriers to access to get into the industry have gone down too.
In the past, mega hits cost $40 million. Now you can make one for, say, $2.4 million. Schafer plans to do just that. and make a documentary about it to demystify the process for kids who think that only big publishers can make games.
So this is not a declaration of war on publishers?
No, it's not a declaration of war on publishers. We wouldn't start that unless we were ready to win it. No, just kidding. Later.
Not now. While Schaefer celebrates his new crowdfunding success, he's not closing the door on old money. He leaves his Rubik's Cube on the table and heads to the conference room where two big publishers are waiting to hear his next pitch. For NPR News, I'm Aarti Shahani.
Now, if you want to watch March Madness, there's no shortage of options. The old-fashioned way, of course, at home on your TV, or you can stream it on your computer at work. But as NPR's Sammy Yenigun reports, the hot ticket this year is streaming on your phone. There's an app for that.
First things first, for most fans, the best way to see a game is from the stands. That's a given. But if you're like Ryan Guthrie, an Indiana Hoosiers fan living in a city far from home, you've got to have a plan B.
I would always prefer to have a big screen, a big high-definition television screen, if I can. But I mean, I guess I'm just old school.
For the past few years, Guthrie and his fellow IU fans have come to watch Indiana games at the Union Pub in Washington, D.C. They're draped in red, double-fisting chicken wings and beer. These guys are pumped that Indiana beat their rival Purdue in the last game of the regular season. And then there's Mike White from Madison, Wisconsin. He's new school. He's watching on his phone while waiting for the subway.
I knew I was going to be in D.C. with my family, so I said, well, I'll download the app so I can see the game while I'm out there, because I didn't expect there'd be any place that would have it.
White says he was at home watching the Badgers play on TV, and he saw a commercial telling him he could stream games on his mobile device. You know, there have been a lot of those lately.
Did you just check the game on your phone?
What? No.
Only AT&T's network lets your iPhone download 3 times faster.
And only on Verizon's 4G LTE network.
T-Mobile's super fast 4G smartphones bring the game right to you.
The push to watch games on your phones is coming from a few places. TV networks, cell phone service providers, and the NCAA are all highlighting the big dance on a small screen. Don Perry is a director of applications for T-Mobile. She says there are two reasons that mobile streaming is especially hot this year.
One, the smartphones that we have are getting larger screens, higher definition screens, so it's really fun now to watch on your phone. The second thing is the 4G network, and that means you get better picture quality, you get better sound quality if you're listening to it on the radio.
Streaming the game itself isn't the only way to enjoy sports on a phone. Twitter chit-chat around live sports grows louder by the second, and bracket apps abound in mobile app stores. This year, ESPN doesn't own the rights to mobile stream March Madness games, but through apps like Watch ESPN and ESPN Score Center, they're still trying to pull eyeballs towards phone screens.
They're often to us the very first screen many of us look at in the morning, before even turning on NPR, for instance, and often the last screen we check it at night, before perhaps even tucking in the loved ones.
That's ESPN General Manager of Mobile Michael Bale. He says mobile's the fastest growing platform for ESPN, with over 20 million unique visitors monthly and counting. ESPN now calls mobile phones their first screen, which means that they design all of their coverage around how sports look on a phone.
And then we extract from those principles to include how we then program to both the PC, the television, and even the print experience.
This year, the Madness will tip off at 14 courts across the country and will be watched from more places than ever before. Sammy Yenigun, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
There is usually no shortage of creativity at the South by Southwest Interactive Festival in Austin, but this year one innovation has been controversial: homeless hotspots, a project where homeless people are given wireless cards and people can approach them to exchange donations for access to the internet. Critics of the project say it's exploiting the homeless, but Megan Garber of The Atlantic thinks otherwise. We'll get her take in a second, but first, we'd like to hear from you. Is this project an opportunity for the homeless or exploitation? Call us at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, or you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Megan Garber is a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine. Her piece titled Wi-Fi Hotspots Made of Homeless People, Not as Horrible as They Seem. It ran on The Atlantic website on March 12th, and she joins us now from studios at The Atlantic here in Washington. Megan, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. Thanks. Glad to be here.
So first, you write, it is perfectly okay to be offended at first glance by this project. You call it digital colonialism. So let me ask you, what was your first reaction?
My first reaction was that this was horrible and exploitative, a little bit dystopian, actually. But really, the more I thought about it, the more I just thought, you know, it's a business opportunity like any other for homeless people that don't get very many business opportunities. And I think if any other type of person were, you know, afforded this opportunity, we wouldn't have any problem with it at all. It seems that homelessness itself is the main issue here. And I don't think it should be.
So tell us, how does it work? Who is the company that's sponsoring this, and how does it actually work?
The company is called BBH, which stands for Bartle, Bogle, and Hegarty. They're the marketing firm that also did the Axe body spray commercials, if you remember those. And basically, I mean, one of their main points was just to get the word out about homelessness and the problems that it has.
And so it's a marketing ploy, which we could say should be judged very successful so far.
Got the word out. That is very true.
Okay,
and
they've duly noted.
Run programs before. Yes, definitely. They've run a program before in New York City called Unheard New York, where they were trying to empower people to tell their story by giving them phones that they could use to have Twitter accounts and tell their stories via social media. So this isn't the first time that they've experimented, actually, with charitable initiatives.
But so how does it work, though? There's, as I understand it, 15 homeless people taking part, and what happens?
That's right. So the 15 homeless people were given basically mobile devices where they would have the devices, and they basically converted themselves into mobile hotspots, the same kind that you would have at Starbucks or something like that. And then people who are attending the conference can get sort of immediate Wi-Fi access through those devices.
Because this is all these high-tech techies down there who can't stand to be off network even when they're crossing the street. Is that the idea?
Exactly. And one of the common complaints about the conference, very ironically, is that because there are so many people there using so many devices, the web access is actually not very good. So this was actually trying to solve, believe it or not, a market problem at the conference.
So there's not a set fee. People just give what they want for this access?
Exactly. It's you can give what you want. They suggest about $2 or so, but it can completely vary. The volunteers also get paid a set fee of $20 just for their work. So it's basically, you know, doing work at the conference just like, you know, you would do if you were helping set up, you know, the stands or the tables or anything like that.
And do we have any sense what they're making?
No, they have not released the numbers yet. All that they have told me in my reporting is that the people who tend to be a little bit more gregarious and who really engage conference goers in conversation and talk and really make a point of telling their story, they make a lot more money. But they have not released the exact numbers.
Okay. And they've actually put some of their stories online. Can you tell us a little bit about the people that are taking part in this?
Sure. So the main theme seems to be that, you know, people just really want their stories to be told. They want to sort of take away a little bit of the curiosity, I guess, about homelessness. And they want to sort of make the point that this is not a choice. This is something that happened to me. There's one man, Clarence, who is a victim of Hurricane Katrina. There are other people who there's one person who was a victim of traumatic brain injury. And so he's had trouble finding jobs and just a lot of different stories that I think make the condition of homelessness a lot more relatable.
All right, let's take a call from a listener. Jonathan is in Hammond, Indiana. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, go right ahead.
All right, so I was saying that I think that the company is exploiting the image or the stigma around homelessness negatively, and I think that if this, you know, if the company was willing to do this around, you know, a bookstore or a coffee shop, that this really wouldn't be a question that NPR would host, kind of thing, because it'd just be like, yeah, you know, like we were taking these strides as a society. But I think that this company is exploiting the image of homelessness, and while there might be some people around that have fallen on hard economic times, veterans, people that have had medical issues, that on the flip side, there's also those people that just, I don't want to say are taking their chunk, but, you know, are buying illicit drugs and alcohol. And so there's that fine line between, you know, how do we support the homeless versus, you know, the company image that they're projecting by doing this.
So if you were down there, Jonathan, say you were at the conference and crossing the street and wanted to check your email or something, would you take part in this program and buy access or no?
I personally would not. I think that I have done my fair share of supporting, you know, shelters and places where the homeless can go in a positive manner to you know, get their feet back under them. And so I would not participate in this.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
All right. Thank you very much.
So, Megan, I guess it's a common reaction there.
I think it is, and I think it's a great point because it really is a fine line. I mean, you know, empowering and exploitation, there can be a really small space between the two. And I think all of that is right. I think there are also problems with the optics of it. You know, the whole program is called Homeless Hotspot. So the implication is not that homeless people are using the idea of hotspot to empower themselves. It really conveys this idea of the homeless person being used as a hotspot. And I think, you know, there are problematic things with that. So, you know, I'm not 100% in favor of the way that the program has been marketed. But I think that ultimately, you know, the people are making a choice to participate in the program. They're hoping to use it to tell their story. So I think, you know, in the whole, it's for a good cause, and I think it's a good thing. But it's a very good point. This is not 100% without problems.
And you've written that it kind of juxtaposes poverty and privilege. I mean, the idea of someone sitting there checking their high-powered friend's email next to, I guess it can make for some uncomfortable situations or maybe some engaging situations.
Exactly. And I think the point that it can do both is actually a good thing because, frankly, this is something that we should be talking about. And there are homeless people in Austin just like there are homeless people in most cities. And I think, you know, the tendency is just to ignore it, to say, well, that's not my problem. It's, you know, not part of this conference. And I appreciate that BBH is trying to sort of juxtapose, you know, the real world reality with the digital potential that's being explored at the conference.
All right. We have an email from Katie in Berlin, New Hampshire, who says, just got back from South by Southwest, thought the Wi-Fi homeless idea was great. She says there are two things always in short supply at South by Southwest, taxis and Wi-Fi. If we can help the homeless and solve a problem at the same time, I think it's great. A lot better than making them drive pedicabs. Okay, let's take a phone call here. Troy in Richmond, Virginia. Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I wanted to chime in on the homeless the hotspot issue.
We'd love to hear your opinion.
I think it's both. I think it definitely is exploitation, but I don't necessarily believe that exploitation in this manner is a bad thing if it's regulated. So it may give the homeless person a chance to network. Just because they're homeless doesn't mean they don't have skills and don't have an ability to get back into the workforce. So I think that's good. On the other hand, I think that they need to be fairly compensated. It's like it should go in with like a union right from the beginning of some sort, is my opinion.
Okay, that's an interesting idea. All right, thank you so much. Let's take another quick call here. Robert in New Haven, Connecticut. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi. I completely agree with your guest. I think she's really said all the right things. I would just contribute one thing that I've been in two places where there have been bottle bills introduced, and one of the arguments against a bottle bill.
And you might tell us what that is?
Collecting cans and bottles, putting a deposit on cans and bottles. One of the arguments against them has been that it would be degrading to homeless people to be going around with shopping carts collecting all of these cans and bottles. Well, you know, that's looking out for other people's... I don't think that's necessarily such a altruistic view, and in fact, it's an argument that the bottlers particularly like to make. It benefits everybody, and there aren't a lot of opportunities for this population to get a job and to connect with other people. I think it's very good on many levels. I'm in favor of it.
All right, well, thanks for calling. Megan Garber, the organizers have said that they kind of see this as modernizing the little businesses you see of homeless people selling newspapers that they have produced on the streets. That kind of newspapers are old-fashioned. People don't actually read them anymore, but this is something people could really use, and it's kind of a business concept.
Exactly. And I think they really focused on allowing the people themselves to tell their stories. So that's why, you know, there's conversation involved. You don't just enter a code to get the Wi-Fi access. You actually talk to the people. And they're trying to frame it very entrepreneurially. They're not, you know, like I mentioned, there is the sort of human hotspot framing. But the way that they also talk about it is that the homeless people are actually managers of these technological devices. And, you know, they're selling a product. And part of what they're doing to sell that product is telling their stories. So they're really trying to bring that newspaper idea of, you know, the narrative, the empowering narrative, to the technological world.
And do you have any idea if there are plans to expand this experiment?
Well, it will depend on the success of the experiment. And I think part of the success will be determined by how much money the people actually make. But I really do applaud the idea of, you know, trying to use new technologies to find new ways to help people. And I think as much as we can talk about this being exploitative, I mean, bottom line, these people are volunteering for the program. They're excitedly volunteering. They actually applied for it and, you know, went through a fairly rigorous process to be part of it. So I think ultimately that says everything, that they want to be involved.
And 15 was the limit, but more people wanted to take part.
Right.
Did you speak with the homeless shelter that is also taking part in this, that is sponsoring those?
I did not. I spoke to the head of innovation at BBH, who was running it. I'm unfortunately not in Austin, so I was hoping I could actually talk to some of the people who are on the street there and get that perspective, but I've had to rely on other reporters to do that.
All right, but you've got lots of Wi-Fi here in D.C., so...
Exactly.
All right,
not
well,
as much of a problem for me.
Megan Garber is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and she joined us from studios at the magazine here in Washington. You can find a link to her piece at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Megan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a program aimed at curbing bullying in schools is airing on a popular cable channel this weekend. It's called Speak Up. We'll talk with one of the young men who was featured in the film about why his own parents didn't even know he was being bullied until they saw the film. That conversation is in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about a story that caught our eye, and apparently a lot of yours. We've been hearing a lot about this online. The annual South by Southwest Festival in Austin showcases all that is cool in technology, music, and film. And when surrounded by all that cool stuff, you kind of want to spread the word. One company, BBH, thought that they had come up with an innovative way to connect to the internet at the conference. They handed Wi-Fi hotspots to individuals from a local homeless shelter. They let passersby know they could log on and pay whatever they wanted for the service. Once word got out that this plan was underway, the response from the public beyond Austin ranged from support to outrage. So we wanted to talk some more about this. To get the facts straight, we've called upon New York Times technology reporter Jenna Wortham. She was in Austin for the South by Southwest Festival, and she reported on this story. And also to talk about the ethical implications, we've called once again Jack Marshall, the president and founder of ProEthics, an ethics consulting group. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jenna, what was the idea behind this project that the BBH Labs called Homeless Hotspots?
Well, BBH thought they would sort of kill two birds with one stone. At something like South by Southwest, there's always a problem of getting internet access or connecting to the internet while you're walking around. And they also wanted to bring attention to the relatively large population of homeless people that live in Austin. So they thought they would sort of employ some of those people, enroll them in this voluntary program, and have them walk around and talk to local conference goers and tell them their story, as well as help them get online for a few minutes.
What was their response?
You know, it was all over the place. I mean, I think people that actually did, you know, interact with some of the people, you know, who were participating in the Homeless Hotspots program, sort of, they enjoyed talking to them. Everyone in the program was very, you know, lively and excited and, you know, having a good time being out there. But other people were very discomforted by it. I mean, there was something very, very unsettling about this kind of disconnect between what's a very real world problem, which is homelessness, and kind of this first world problem of not being able to, you know, check your Twitter from your iPhone.
Let me just play a short clip from Emma Cookson, the chairman of BBH New York. That's the parent company behind the project. She was interviewed yesterday on CNN, and she wanted to talk about what some of the participants thought of the program. Let's just listen to that.
Usually, the conference goers just pass them by. They don't stop to talk to them. They actively ignore them. Because of this program, these people are having loads and loads of conversations about their background, about their situation. And it's interesting, a couple of the guys have referred to it as my temporary little business.
So, Jack Marshall, let's bring you into this conversation. How do you respond to this? I mean, Jenna said that a lot of people were discomfited by that. And why do you think that is?
Well, part of it is a phenomenon that I see a lot. And I call it the ick factor, which is that when something is strange and unusual and takes us by surprise, our initial reaction is to say it's bad or it's unethical. But if we try to think about why it's unethical, we actually can't find out something. I think that was at work strong here. And the other tendency is that we tend to look at conduct by what we presume the motives behind it are, whereas judging the conduct, there are things where we do the right thing for the wrong reason. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm cynical that this was in fact done for the benefit of the homeless, but the fact is I think it did benefit the homeless. And if we were when I finally thought about it, I realized if they had hired some cheerleaders in bikinis or students to do this, nobody would be outraged at all. They'd say it's a job. Well, here are 13 volunteers who consented to it, and they benefited from it. I mean, they had a better day and met some people. So I find it odd that we would criticize the organization for trying this when most of us pay no attention to the homeless people at all.
I'm speaking with Jack Marshall. He is an ethics consultant, and Jenna Werthmann, an ex-technology reporter, on a story that caught our attention about homeless people being used as Wi-Fi hotspots at the South by Southwest Festival that just concluded in Austin. So Jenna, what about that? Did people talk to you about this? When you were reporting your story, what did people say to you? Was there kind of the ick factor? People said they were uncomfortable, but they didn't really know why?
Absolutely. I think that's fair. But I think the underlying issue there, though, was that, you know, BBH said they were going to pay each participant a stipend of $20 per day. Plus, you know, they were able to accept donations for conference goers. They could pay what they wanted to for access to the internet to the hotspots. And then BBH also said they would make sure that each participant got $50 to $60 per day for their help. And I think there's a sense that that's not really, of course, they were advised on how much on that pricing to sort of what would be responsible and a reasonable amount for the people in the program. But there's a sense that you're not actually going to ever, you know, become, you know, get out of homelessness if that's how much money that you're making per day. I mean, that doesn't feel like a living wage to a lot of people. And I think that's the sense. I mean, these aren't college kids. They aren't interns. They are, you know, grown men and women who are actually trying to, you know, transition back into a regular living and working situation. And this is not necessarily going to get them there.
So, but it is interesting. I mean, you heard Jack Marshall's point, which is that $20 that you did get is better than the $20 that you didn't get. And that if people were college students or something, people really wouldn't have thought about this at all. I'm interested, Jenna, what was the most kind of clearly articulated objection that you heard? Was it the idea that it's not a living wage and that it's somehow demeaning to pay these adults this? Or is it the idea of you're turning the human being into an object in a way? You're turning it's the idea of the human hotspot somehow, like the walking billboard, something that people find that disturbing. What was the most clearly articulated objection that you heard?
I think it was that. I think it was the sense that when the actual technical infrastructure, you know, of the cellular networks crumbled down or fall apart, we turned to humans and used humans as infrastructure. I think people felt that sort of was incredibly dehumanizing and sort of very reductive in a way that was just very unsettling. I mean, I think that was the clearest thing that made people uncomfortable.
So, Jack, you tossed this around in your head, and I think you gave us a clue about where you're heading on this. Did you start out thinking it was a bad idea and then came around to the idea that it wasn't after all? And what was kind of the linchpin of this for you?
That's exactly right. And actually, I think the epiphanal moment for me was I was in New York yesterday and I saw a guy in a full Woody costume from Toy Story handing out flyers. And I said, now that is worse than having to walk around being wired. I mean, actually, what these guys were doing was interesting. It was presented in perhaps a dehumanizing way, but I guess what we're talking about then is the phrasing of the lettering on the T-shirt, which said, I am a hotspot. All right, maybe the phrasing was incorrect. But the fact is, the alternative for these guys is not a living wage or a new career. It's begging on the street or having an experience that might, in fact, motivate them and excite them to do something else. So it looks to me like all the results are positive, and the revulsion at it really is, I think, the ick factor at work. And if the end result is we focus more attention at the homeless problem generally, then that's a good result as well.
Jack Marshall is the president and founder of Pro Ethics and Ethics Consultancy Group. He was kind enough to join us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Jack, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jenna Wortham is the technology reporter for The New York Times, and she joined us from her office in New York. Jenna, thank you so much.
My pleasure.